Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Craig Hofer, and I represent the appellant in this case, Tanya Templeton. Ms. Templeton formerly was married to the respondent, Eric Lindhorst, before their marriage was dissolved in 1998. Nearly a decade after the entry of the original decree, Ms. Templeton brought, for the first time, a motion to increase the amount of child support and to compel Mr. Lindhorst to pay certain health care expenses that he had refused to pay. Ms. Templeton's motion did not seek any modification of maintenance. Approximately a year and a half later, and in response to Ms. Templeton's motion, Mr. Lindhorst filed a cross motion seeking to actually reduce his child support obligation and to terminate his maintenance obligation altogether. Following a hearing on the motions, the trial court entered a judgment increasing the amount of child support but reducing the amount of maintenance by one half. The trial court's judgment gives rise to two principal issues on appeal. The first issue relates to whether the trial court's decision to reduce maintenance was against the weight of the evidence, erroneously declared or misapplied the law, or reflected an abuse of discretion. The second issue relates to whether the trial court abuses discretion by not adhering to its own local rule and choosing not to make the increased child support award retroactive to the date that the motion to modify was originally served upon Mr. Lindhorst. Addressing these issues in order, a maintenance award by statute may be modified only upon a showing of changed circumstances so substantial and continuing as to make the terms of the original award unreasonable. The requisite changed circumstances must be proven by detailed evidence, and the party seeking the modification, in this case, Mr. Lindhorst, carries the burden of establishing that the terms of the original decree have become unreasonable. To satisfy this burden, Mr. Lindhorst must produce detailed evidence of both the circumstances as they existed at the time of the modification and at the time of the original decree. The trial court's decision thus requires reversal if the respondent, as in this case, failed to meet his burden of proving through detailed evidence changed circumstances so substantial and continuing as to make the terms of the original maintenance award unreasonable. The evidence presented to the trial court at the modification hearing revealed that there had been no substantial and continuing change in circumstances warranting a modification of maintenance.
Didn't the trial court specifically find that the wife could meet her reasonable needs with her lesser amount of maintenance?
Yes, he did. The trial court did, but I believe that was based on flawed reasoning for a variety of reasons. First, the court imputed income to Ms. Templeton based upon testimony of a vocational rehab expert that was retained by Mr. Lindhorst.
And also a medical doctor who dealt with rheumatoid arthritis, surveillance.
Sorry, sir. Because I'm having a hard time hearing you. I have hearing deficiencies. Sorry.
I'll try to speak up, too. Didn't the trial court, in addition to hearing testimony from a vocational expert, also hear testimony from a medical doctor who had some expertise in rheumatoid arthritis, who had watched Mrs. Lindhorst on surveillance videos and then also reviewed records?
Right. There was testimony from both a medical expert as well as a vocational expert. The issue with respect to the medical expert really is that, you know, he determined that she was no longer, or he disagreed with the Social Security Administration's determination that she was totally disabled. He believed that she was different than the individual that may have been presented at the Social Security Administration's determination that she may have improved through medication. Even assuming that is correct and that she was no longer disabled, the trial court found that at best she could work part-time, 20 hours a week, in a sedentary position as a registered nurse.
Wouldn't she lose her Social Security?
Yes, she would. And that's the real crux of this case. But going back to the vocational rehab expert, the report that he submitted as his expert report, the testimony that he provided was that he based his study solely on full-time nursing positions. He had not contacted any employer within the St. Louis metropolitan area to determine whether there are any availability.
Doesn't that really go to the weight of his testimony, though, as opposed to the sufficiency?
I think it goes to the fact that it's based on speculation, which, as you know, a trial court cannot rely or base its decision on pure speculation. In this case, because Mr. Caver, as the expert witness, did not conduct any survey of part-time positions within the St. Louis metropolitan area, as to, you know, positions available, as to compensation, and so forth, in direct direct violation of his regular practice. The regular practice, as he testified to, is that he waits just before trial to conduct that type of survey to determine that there actually is availability. In this situation, he limited his study to only full-time positions. It was only at the urging of the trial court judge who asked him, you know, sort of sua sponte, you know, are there part-time positions out there? Because he had not conducted a survey, all he could offer was, well, I believe there is somewhere out there in the marketplace based on, you know, prior experience, there probably is part-time positions. But again, that is purely speculation, and that cannot serve as a basis for imputing income.
Regardless whether this court agrees with that or not, it's your position that you can't consider both the Social Security and that part-time, and that if you consider either one or the other, there's no change in circumstances because that's the same income as previously?
Correct. Right. If you look at the, you know, the facts in this case, Ms. Templeton had tried working for a period of time. She was advised by her physician, who also happened to be her employer, that she could no longer work. He recommended to her that she then seek out Social Security disability, because he had tried using her in his office, found that she had come to a point in her health that she was no longer functional, at least as a registered nurse. So she obtained Social Security disability benefits. And based on those benefits, they were actually slightly less than what she was earning as a part-time nurse. As a part-time nurse, she was making around $1,300. Through her Social Security disability benefits, she was earning somewhere around $1,250. So there was a slight decrease. What the respondent in this case is arguing is that, you know, that the trial court was correct in adding both of those together to determine whether there had been a change in circumstances. What I am trying to argue to this court is that's a legal impossibility. You cannot, under the Social Security regulations, while they do provide for a brief trial period where you can work and they won't penalize you, but if you work for in any gainful substantial activity past a certain brief trial period, which I believe is six months to 9 months, after that, you're no longer eligible for Social Security disability.
And respondent's counsel argues you had to introduce that in evidence, and you argue that's a matter for judicial notice?
Right. I'm arguing that since that goes to a legal issue as opposed to a factual issue, that you know, this is really, the Social Security regulations are really no different than a case law. You know, you are not required to advise a trial court. You know, this is the case law. You know, and if you fail to follow that case law, then you know. What I'm arguing is, you know, that's no different. So
opposing counsel also seems to argue that we should consider the $600+ a month that the two children get from Social Security as if it were all additional income to her in terms of determining that she has extra resources now.
Well, I'd argue that that's actually under the tax law, that's income to the children. That may be a factor to consider in determining child support. I don't think it relates to maintenance, and it should be kept separate from maintenance. So, any further questions?
So what are you asking the court to do?
What I'm asking the court to do is determine that the trial court erred in including child support, including the Social Security disability benefits along with the imputed income, and determine that there had been a substantial and continuing change in circumstance to result in the modification of the maintenance. So what I'm asking this court to do is find that the court erred in doing that, and as a result, restore the maintenance to its original level that it was in existence at the time of the original decree.
Well, if you're correct that that it's an error in law for the court to have considered part-time income plus the Social Security, wouldn't the appropriate remedy be to remand it to the court for further determination on maintenance, because the finding that she needed less is supported by evidence? It may be that he erred in law when he added the two together. Wouldn't it be more appropriate for the trial court to make the determination of what the appropriate maintenance award should be, other than to this court to just say it's a goes back to the other amount when there is a finding supported by at least the testimony of a couple expert witnesses that she was available to work at this time?
Again, I think, you know, the testimony that she was available to work really puts her in no different position than she was at the time of the original decree. If you look at the facts in this case, at the time that the original decree of maintenance was entered in this case, she was a part-time employee working as a nurse who had been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And based on that, the trial court determined in the original proceeding that she could arguably work no more than, you know, 20 hours a week. When you look at the evidence that was provided and considered by the trial court in this case, in the modification hearing, the court came to the same conclusion, that she, again, has rheumatoid arthritis. It was based on the expert testimony that was given by the medical expert retained by Mr. Lindhorst, that she could work no more than 20 hours a week in a sedentary position. So if you look at it, there's really been no change whatsoever, no substantial change in the position of her in terms of her ability to work. There has been a change, but the change has been that she has actually incurred, her living expenses have increased considerably because of her health care costs. So based on the fact that from a legal perspective, there's been no change in circumstance, I don't know if there's a real need to remand the case back to the court, but rather I believe this court is empowered to enter an order saying that there was no substantial and continuing change in circumstance as a matter of law. As such, there should have been no modification as to maintenance at all.
Can you really briefly address the issue of
retroactivity? I'll do it with my 1 second here.
You can go ahead and answer my question.
Okay,
why do you argue it was an error, abuse of discretion, not to make the child support award increase retroactive further?
Basically, again, you know, the trial court was bound by its own local rules. Its own local rules specifically provide that there is a presumption that you know, any modification of child support, whether it's an increase or a decrease, should be made retroactive to the date that the motion was served on the opposing counsel. In this case, and, you know, subsequent cases that have considered the discretion of the court in modifying child support and determining when that modification should take place has made clear that you should balance the equities of the case. You should look at the financial conditions of the parties and determine, you know, based on that, what is the appropriate modification. Given, you know, if you look at the equities in this case, we have a disabled woman who, throughout the litigation, you know, provide for all the children's needs in terms of, you know, medical needs, housing needs, vision, and so forth. There is a great disparity in the financial condition of the parties. On the one hand, you have someone who is receiving Social Security disability benefits. On the other hand, you have an attorney who's practicing, making, you know, he claimed to the court only $60,000. The court, you know, found that was grossly understated. Found that he was making at least $120,000. Given the, you know, there's case law where you have a an attorney who had misrepresented his income throughout the litigation. In that case, the court found that it was proper to, you know, award the maintenance back to the date of the original proceeding.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay.
May it please the court. Briefly, I want to address the question about the retroactive child support payment. According to the local rule, which is attached to appellant's brief, there's a presumption of retroactivity back to the date of the movement's statement of income and expense or the service of the motion to modify, whichever shall occur later. The original statement of income and expense was filed with the motion. During trial, the appellant again amended the statement of income and expense, and the final statement of income and expense was submitted after trial.
So it's your position that any modification of that document would negate the presumption?
I would, and I would also argue that if appellant is arguing that there was an abuse of discretion, that the court has to consider whether this failure to apply retroactive child support is so shocking. And I don't think
what was significant about going back 1 month? What happened then as opposed to, was there a change in circumstance during the period after the motion was filed that child support needs really didn't arise till later, or what was the basis?
Yes, because this case was filed in 2006, and the case was actually heard in 2009.
And so, what was the evidence that there was a difference in the children's needs during that period?
Appellant testified as to her expenses.
What evidence supported not making it retroactive back to when the motion was filed?
Because there had been an increase in expenses. The case law suggests that if there's not a big disparity in the amount of increase in child support, that you have overcome the presumption that the child support should be retroactive to the date of filing.
What was the difference here in the two amounts? How much was it increased?
Around $2,000. The expenses were increased $2,000. The increase in child support was by like $123.
And so I'm still not quite clear. So why was that not significant enough to need to be made retroactive back to the filing of the motion?
Because of the length of the length.
Are you saying there was evidence that those increased expenses didn't in fact exist when the motion
Correct.
Was filed? What was
Correct.
That evidence?
That it wasn't until the date of the trial that the appellant attempted to introduce a second amended statement of income and expenses showing at the date of trial the increase in expenses. There was no testimony that the increase in expenses occurred in 2006 or occurred shortly after 2006. All we have is a testimony on the date of trial that the expenses had increased. Am I answering your question?
Well, there was also a filing of a statement of income and expenses at the time of the filing of the motion, which showed an increase. Is that right? An increase in
Correct.
Expenses?
Correct.
Okay. Are you saying that was not valid, or just?
No, I'm not saying that this is not valid. I'm saying that the local rule says that.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about the evidence. I'm trying to get what evidence was there to support, separate from the rule, what was the evidence to support the trial court's decision not to make it retroactive? I mean, you can't just pick a date. There should be some basis on which the court decides.
I don't know that evidence was presented as specific determinations of specific increments of increases. We just have this one income and expense statement, and then suddenly at the trial, an increase in expenses. Most of the evidence regarding the income and expense statement was strictly the testimony of the appellant. The exhibits that were introduced that showed specific increase in or specific medical bills and copays was documented with exhibits. But regarding the rest of the increase, it was strictly the appellant's testimony.
Thank you.
Ms. Lindhorst Templeton raise the issue to the trial court that it was improper to impute job income as well as Social Security disability income? Was that issue ruled upon by the trial court?
Regarding the disability, there are a couple of issues. First of all, at the original dissolution, Ms. Templeton was not determined to be disabled.
Correct.
All that the court found was that she suffered from rheumatoid arthritis that arguably prevented her from working more than 20 hours a week. And I think probably the most instructive place to look is if you look at the post-trial opinion on respondent's motion regarding child support, it shows Let me just pull it up real quick.
So at the time of a trial, the children weren't on Social Security either, then?
Pardon me?
The children were not on Social Security dependent allowance either.
The children were receiving $334 a month each as a benefit of mother's Social Security.
At the first trial, there was no application for disability.
There was none whatsoever for mother or children.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The court considered that in making its modification of child support. It was aware of that at the time it issued its ruling. What I'm not clear is why you, in effect, if I understood your brief right, you're saying that was appropriate that it decided not to consider that in determining child support, but it should have considered it in determining maintenance for the mother. But that money goes to the kids, not to the mother.
There's two different payments. There's the $1,200 that mom receives for Social Security and the children.
Right.
I don't know that the court doesn't specifically refer to it as income. It just says it recognizes that mother receives this benefit for the children. I think it has to be considered a financial resource. However, the court properly excluded it under the Form 14 instructions from the child support.
But it's not her income in terms of maintenance. At some point, you talk about her getting $1,800, and she doesn't. She gets $1,200.
No, but the court did recognize that is money coming into the household.
Right.
The problem is, there is no specific finding of a fact as to how the court arrived at the maintenance determination.
Well, we do know it considered
Social Security. Was there a request for findings of fact in this case? The conclusion?
A very general one. And the judge responded, I always give a written finding.
They asked for findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Correct. Okay.
But there was, the court did find that she had Social Security and imputed income.
The ruling, it says that the court says that it recognizes the imputed income, the imputed income as income to the mother, in addition to the Social Security benefit, but doesn't characterize the Social Security benefit as income. I don't know that there is a necessary distinction between a financial resource and characterizing something as income. Regardless, with an incomplete record, we cannot tell whether just because the court recognizes that mother is receiving a Social Security benefit, we cannot tell from this record whether the judge used that in calculating what she needs to meet her reasonable needs.
Your opponent argues the imputed income was based on 20 hours part-time work, and that was exactly what her level of employment was at the time of the original decree, so there is no change of circumstance.
However, he fails to admit that in that same sentence, the court recognizes first that she arguably suffers from RA, limiting her ability to suffering from RA, and has young children at home. At the time of the original decree, the children were 5 and 21 months or 4 and 21 months.
If not having children at home doesn't cause her to be able to work more than 20 hours, what's the significance of that?
I don't think I understand your question.
Well, the importance of working 20 hours is she can generate income to support herself. And if not having young children at home is not a factor allowing her to work more hours, what's the significance of that change?
The significance is that she was determined to be disabled and was receiving income, receiving disability benefits, and that the court found that she was able to work.
But so you are saying that the court imputed both income and Social Security benefits?
In determining whether there had been a change in circumstance.
So how can they do that when the law does not allow that? Can you address this issue about you cannot continue to receive Social Security benefits when you are earning money, so you can't, the court could not consider that she had both?
And I will
pick one or the other, but not both.
And I will refer to the judge's answer in respondent's post-trial motion, where he specifically states that he follows the Form 14 guideline for determining what benefits can be included, and specifically states these benefits are provided while the disability exists. So he does not include that in the Form 14. In his finding, he specifically states this woman is not disabled.
So she would not be getting Social Security benefits, so imputed income, and I, assuming that is supported, but then there's no change in circumstance because, as Judge Breckenridge said, she was working 20 hours at the time of the original dissolution. So what's the distinction?
I believe,
and you pointed to the Social Security benefits, and so then you can't. What's the basis for saying you can consider both? And
I believe that the judge did not think that this woman was entitled to disability benefits and did not include that in income.
Then there was no substantial change in circumstances because she could work 20 hours a week at the dissolution. She could work 20 hours a week later at the modification.
I think she's receiving this money into her household. It was not strictly the disability that formed the basis for the change in circumstance. At the time of the original
didn't the
dissolution.
Judge also make a specific finding that her reasonable needs had gone down, which is a factor, statutory factor, to be considered in the maintenance award?
The only statement that he made was that she cohabitated at the time of the dissolution.
She lived
obviously with her husband, then moved into an apartment at the time of the modification. She had been living with her parents for some period of time. The court recognized that she was sharing expenses with a person with whom she was cohabitating.
What was the evidence on that? Because opposing counsel says the only evidence was that she said these were her expenses, not expenses she shared. Excuse me, she shared with her parents, and that there was no evidence showing that some portion of these was paid by someone else.
It was all based on mother's testimony. Mother testified that the parents owned the house, and yet mother voluntarily paid rent. Mother testified that
she said she paid rent. She didn't say she voluntarily paid rent. Is that right? I mean, she didn't have to pay rent, but she did.
There was no lease agreement that was introduced. There was no.
Okay.
She
showed double expenses, and the court didn't, that her expenses had doubled, and the court may or may not have accepted all her evidence.
Correct.
Said
we don't know.
What was the evidence? Opposing counsel, you didn't get a chance to reply to their reply. And
correct.
In the reply, they said there was no basis for the trial court's finding that she shared expenses, that she may have shared those costs with her parents, because her only testimony was that those were her expenses, not ones she shared. And so I wondered if you could point me to the record that would support that was not all her expenses, that they were in fact shared.
She testified that all of the household expenses were paid out of the parents' checking account.
Okay.
She testified that she voluntarily paid rent for a parent's house, that she paid the car payment that was titled in parent's name.
Was there a contest of her increased medical expenses, or was that?
She presented evidence of increased medical expenses.
Okay.
Do you agree that the trial court found that her income was both the imputed income and the Social Security benefit?
I don't think there's any way to tell. As far as determining what.
The language in the decree is the court imputes income of $1,600 per month. The court recognizes this as income in addition to her Social Security disability benefit. Isn't that expressly finding that the court is adding the two together?
I don't necessarily think it is. The court, according to the statute, looks at the financial resources, looks at whether the party shares expenses, looks at the unemployed party's ability to be employed. I don't know whether, and I don't have any case law on this, whether recognizing that financial resources, such as sharing a home with parents, is considered income. I don't know.
The court also found the testimony of the expert that she was able to work full time to be credible. Is that right?
According to the trial transcript, that issue was brought up to the expert, and the expert testified whether or not there was a survey prepared for part-time employment, part of his full-time job is placing nurses in these specific positions to which he testified.
So was there any finding by the court on whether or not she could work full-time?
The court didn't.
The court found she could work part-time, right?
At a minimum, yes.
All right.
Just briefly, Judge, to address your question, case law says that if there aren't specific findings of fact, that the opinion has to be considered favorable, or the facts need to be assumed to be favorable to the opinion.
Does that apply when you ask for findings of fact and conclusions of law under 7301? Or doesn't that mean then
except
the court
that
has
it was a statement for it.
I mean, isn't that all you
appellant
have to do
asked the judge to make findings of fact?
Okay.
No, I think that they had the ability to say, if you find that my mm-hmm. expenses are not reasonable, state with specificity which okay. expenses you do not find, that was not made. And I would ask that the court affirm the Court of Appeals decision and the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Just touching real briefly, and I'll make sure when the red light goes on, I will stop talking. But in terms of findings as to her living expenses, you know, the court, all it said was that the finding that it made was that it was unclear as to exactly what portion of the household expenses were the responsibility of Ms. Templeton, and simply assumed that by living with her parents, some of the Templeton's expenses were shared and commies were achieved. But when you look at the actual evidence in this case, her statement of income and expenses that she submitted and she updated prior to trial showed that as she testified at trial, the only expenses that she listed on her statement of income and expenses were those that she borne out herself. There were certain expenses being paid by the parents.
Was the trial court required to accept that as true? I thought the trial court could believe all part or none of the testimony or evidence of any witness.
And that is true. But in this case, as the language of the trial court's finding would indicate, he wasn't clear as to what were the responsibilities, and so he made an assumption that there must be some shared economies. That, I am saying, is, trial court determinations cannot be based on assumptions. They have to be based on the evidence that's in before them. And if you look at the evidence in this case, the evidence shows that the expenses listed in her statement of income and expenses were hers and hers alone. So again, I guess respect to retroactivity issue, one of the points I would raise in conjunction with that issue is that yes, this case began back in 2006. It was not tried until 2009. Part of the reason for that was the difficulty in trying to assess Mr. Lintorf's financial condition so that we could actually make a determination as to, was proper for child support, was proper for maintenance. He submitted a number of documents, as the trial court indicated in his findings. They were not believable. So it took quite some time to try to assess what his true financial condition was. And that delayed the process. And during that same time period, my client, Ms. Templeton, was responsible, again, for meeting the primary needs of the children, which would normally have been met through child support. So it makes reasonable sense to me that the child support should be made retroactive to the date that this case began.
What exactly did you ask the court for by way of findings of facts?
At the beginning of the trial, I said to the trial court, pursuant to the rule, I wanted to go on the record that I wanted to make a request for specific findings of fact and conclusions of law in this case. And the trial judge indicated to me, I always do that in this case, don't worry about it. I always do that, so you'll get that.
The case law says, however, that under the rule you're required to identify the issues upon which you want the findings of fact. Are you saying that you weren't required to do that because of the trial court's acquiescence in preparing them?
We had off discussions outside of the record before the trial began, and I made it clear I want basically factual determinations made on each of the issues that are of significance to this case in terms of determining child support, maintenance, and so forth.
But that's not in the record.
That's not on the record. That's when he said, I always do that. So.
What if any factual what if anything do you think, as you sit here today, is deficient in the trial court's judgment as it relates to findings of fact?
In terms of findings of fact, I don't think there is any deficiencies.
Okay.
I think he makes statements in his, statements were contained in the findings of fact and in his conclusion that would suggest that there are some, he made some determinations based on speculation, based on assumption, and I think those are error.
But then that boiled down to who had the burden to prove it, though?
Well, the burden of proof was
on my
client, but rather on the respondent, because this was a motion to modify.
Right.
The burden was on the respondent in this case to prove detail or provide detailed evidence to the trial court to demonstrate that there was a substantial continuing change in circumstance that would warrant a modification of maintenance in this case.
If you got the judgment of modification that reflected, in your opinion, Social Security being considered a part of her available income, did you file post-judgment motions with the court?
I did not, because based on my reading of the rule, since it did not go to the form or language of the judgment, but rather relate to a legal error, I didn't think I was required to. But more importantly, the respondent did file a post-trial motion, and the issue was raised in conjunction with that. He raised it in the context of child support, saying that it should be, the trial court should include both the imputed income and Social Security disability benefit receipt in determining child support.
But I argued
to the court at that time that this was a legal impossibility because of the way the rules of the regulations are written with respect to receipt of Social Security.
Was it an amended judgment issued after that?
No. He denied the response motion for post-trial motion, and then we went ahead with the appeal to the Eastern District. Thank you, Your Honors.
Case is taken under submission.